Last week, after a visit with Vladimir Putin on the phone and a physical visit from Volodymyr Zelensky, President Trump said that very soon he would be meeting with Vladimir Putin, and that his Secretary of State Rubio would be meeting with his counterpart Sergey Lavrov, and then hopefully this summit in Budapest would bring together an end to this war, something President Trump has been saying from the beginning of his presidency, that that's what he was going to bring into effect. And now then he's saying, well, I think maybe we're there. Now, there's devils in the details, we always say on these things, but there's a little bit more than a devil in this detail as we're trying to figure out, is this even theoretically possible to get to an end of war, or, and maybe some in the European side, are maybe pushing for more conflict, not for more peace. And to try and help us make sense out of this, we have back with us the ever-popular Colonel Douglas McGregor, defense and foreign policy analyst, former advisor to Secretary of Defense, and highly decorated combat veteran. Doug, as always, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Dan.
And let's just jump right into it. As I mentioned there in the outset, despite what Trump said over the weekend, you've also got the European Union seeming they're trying to push in opposite directions. This is released just earlier today, a joint statement on Ukraine by, you see there, it's headlined by Zelensky, Starmer, Merz, Macron, Maloney, Tusk, von der Leyen, she got her name in there, and then a bunch of others. And what they say together is, we are all united in our desire for a just and lasting peace. That phrase they keep saying all the time, because it's deserved by the people of Ukraine. We strongly support President Trump's position that fighting should stop immediately. Cool, that's good so far. And that the current line of contact should be the starting point for negotiations. Okay, we start to get into some trouble there. We remain committed to the principle that the international borders must not be changed by force. Yes, we're starting to get into really nuts now. Russia's stalling tactics have shown time and again that Ukraine is the only party serious about peace. Therefore, we are clear that Ukraine must be in the strongest possible position before, during, and after any ceasefire. We must ramp up the pressure on Russia's economy and its defense industry until Putin is ready to make peace. We are developing measures to use the full value of Russia's immobilized sovereign assets, i.e. steal Russia's money in Western banks, so that Ukraine has the resources it needs. What do you make of just the intent behind all of these really kind of disconnected claims?
Well, that's a great set of statements to explore. Let's go through them a little bit. I'm not sure we have time to go through all of them. But the bottom line is that listening to the European Union and the Financial Times and other globalist outlets is like listening to the Communist Party of the Soviet Union back in the 1960s and 70s. Everything is remote from reality. Someone said to me the other day that they were convinced that Mr. Netanyahu wants war to go on because that's his way to cling to power. That may be true. I would argue that that is certainly the case for Starmer in London, Macron in Paris, and Merz in Berlin. So I think an awful lot of what they say is bound up with the notion that, quote unquote, if we can't keep this thing going in Ukraine, then we will be not just embarrassed, but ultimately held accountable and thrown out of office, if not directly in the path of an onrushing bus. So I think that's really how you have to read this. What they want has nothing to do with American national interests. And I noted the other day, I guess it was John Mearsheimer who said, well, if the United States leaves NATO, leaves Europe, or without NATO, Europe falls apart. I don't agree with that. I think Europe will spring back to life. Yeah. NATO is strangling it, and we need to get out. President Trump has always instinctively thought this way. And I know that from personal experience of talking with him. The problem for President Trump is that he's not a free agent. And this is what people need to understand. He can't show up in Budapest for a meeting that is designed to produce a new security relationship between both the United States and Russia, as well as ultimately the foundation for a new security structure in Europe, or for that matter, even in the world. I mean, now, I think we need a new relationship, not just with Russia, but with the world. We need to change fundamentally our national security policy, our national military strategy. But that's not something that Trump, I think, believes he can do. And so the expectation in Moscow is, well, if you come over here, then let's get down to brass tacks and talk about these really important things. It's not just a question of reaching some sort of settlement in Ukraine. It's much larger. He can't go there and deliver on those promises. He doesn't have the political support on the Hill. Washington, as you know, is permanently in a state of endless war to preserve what in their minds is U.S. military and economic hegemony. They can't leave that. They can't walk away from it. If Trump has no support for that sort of thing, whatever he says or promises probably doesn't have much meaning. So what President Trump tends to opt for is what we've talked about before, which is, look, let's have a great theatrical event, you know, a Trump special, another sort of excursion into Trump's reality TV show. See what I've just done. I brought peace. Well, the ceasefire that he brought peace to in the Middle East is almost dead on arrival. I don't think it has much chance of surviving. The Israelis could care less. They're pursuing their own agenda, and he obviously has no influence over them. They, on the other hand, seem to have tremendous influence over him. So he's looking for another event where he can say, well, we had a talk. We're going to go to a ceasefire. We've traded horses. Vladimir Putin and I are, we have a good relationship and we're really friends now. That's what he's looking for. That's not going to happen.
So the whole
mirage.
Kind of to your point, Gary, I'm going to go a little bit out of order here. To your point about the made-for-TV show, theatrics, here's what, over the weekend, a couple of different things Trump said about what he's trying to accomplish.
In my opinion, they should stop the war immediately. You go by the battle line, wherever it is. Otherwise, it's too complicated. You'll never be able to figure it out. Stop right now at the battle line. I told that to President Zelensky. I told it to President Putin.
What do you think should happen with the Donbas region?
Let it be cut the way it is. It's cut up right now. I think 78% of the land is already taken by Russia. You leave it the way it is right now. They can negotiate something later on down the line.
So first of all, this just wherever the lines are, let's go ahead and meet right now. Let's get this done. And then it's like, all right. They can keep the Donbass part, I guess, but let's meet in Budapest. What do you make of just this seemingly disconnected requirements?
For Russia, everything happening in Ukraine is of existential importance. In other words, they can't tolerate a government in Kiev that is permanently hostile to Russia, its national security, its population, and that is simply not understood by President Trump or anybody in Washington. They don't see it in those terms. They don't understand that just as Mexico and what goes on in Mexico has an existential quality for us, the same is true for Russia. You know, when we talk about Mexico, we fail to point out that if you had a large foreign alien presence in Mexico from China or Russia, Iran, anywhere else, that was arming, equipping, and sustaining Mexican armed forces that were designed to do one thing and only thing, which is attack the United States, we would be up in arms. And we wouldn't pay attention to anything anybody said about it, because that's existential for us. If we do nothing, well, then these forces in Mexico will overwhelm the Southwest, half of California, New Mexico, Arizona, most of Texas. What are we supposed to do? Well, that's effectively the same thing for Russia. There's no understanding of that. For everyone in the United States that is involved in this sort of business, in this particular administration on the Hill, everything is short term. Sure, they're bankrolled by a lot of wealthy donors that want to destroy Russia. But their real thinking is, well, let's give our donors a win. How do we do that? Well, we have to inflict some permanent damage on Russia. Well, that really hasn't worked very well. That's why in the Financial Times article that you mentioned earlier, there's discussion now about taking the, $160 billion, some outrageous number of money that is actually Russian-owned, a Russian asset, and turning it over to the Ukrainians to keep, quote-unquote, the regime in Kiev going, to find a way to sustain the conflict. This is insane. I'm sure that President Trump doesn't want that. But what President Trump wants, he's not going to get. He's not going to get the short-fused, boom, we have a win here. Come on down, pick a new number. I mean, that's the Trump view of diplomacy. That's not what we're talking about. And what we need is something like the Congress of Berlin in 1879, where all the great powers got together and they sat around a table and it went on for a few weeks and eventually they came up with a solution. It wasn't perfect, but avoided war at that stage for another 30 plus years. We need something like that. But that means that everybody gives something and everybody walks with some measure of success away and some don't. But you have to have a larger Congress, a larger meeting. We don't want to do that. We want to be the center of everything. That's certainly Donald Trump's wish. He doesn't want to be bothered with what these Europeans say because he knows their influence is malicious, mendacious. They're not interested in a settlement. They're interested in keeping this thing going because of what we said before. They're globalists. They're on a very, very edge of being removed. They don't have a future. That's clear. That is absolutely abundantly clear in Europe today. So they need the war to justify their existence. That's going to start in Britain and France, but eventually it's going to get to Germany. All of this is going to be overturned and changed. That's a good thing. We should welcome that. But we have to get out of this mindset that Russia maintains military power for the purpose of invading Europe. It isn't. That's not the case. It never has been. Trump understands that. I think most Europeans privately are figuring that out. But those governments won't admit it.
You know, there was a question that was asked of Trump in the Oval Office yesterday by, I believe it was a European reporter. And the way she phrased her question was, I think, instructive. But you can also hear some agitation in Trump's voice, maybe for an additional or separate reason that maybe he realizes that he's not, you know, this omnipotent power that some ascribe him to. Listen to this.
Would you support Senator Lindsey Graham's bill to declare Russia a terrorist state? And you have within your power the most powerful man on earth. Why don't you just enable Ukraine to finish this war tomorrow?
Well, if you knew anything about what you were talking about, you'd be able. You do? I don't think you do, really. I don't think you do because it's a little more complicated than that. But it sounds easy. We're in the process of trying to make a deal. If we make a deal, that's great. If we don't make a deal, it'll be a lot of people are going to be paying a big price.
So just the question itself of, well, gosh, you're the most powerful man on the planet. Why don't you just give them what they need? As though there's some package that exists somewhere that if only they had it, bam, war would be over. What do you make of that?
Well, President Trump has been enlightened lately about the true state of our military power. He may not say it publicly, but he's been shown some statistics. And the arsenal is at a low ebb. In other words, instead of having the desired level of readiness in terms of missiles in our inventory, missiles in the magazine, he's been shown the magazine, and the magazine is half empty, maybe more. He's actually said publicly, we've already given as much as we can give to Ukraine in terms of equipment and technology. We really can't give them anything else without putting ourselves in jeopardy. We've already done that. We are in jeopardy right now. He doesn't have the missiles, the rockets, the equipment, and so forth to give away to Ukraine, even though we know it's a shell game with money. Congress appropriates money. We ship the stuff out to Ukraine. Most of that money is sort of turned around internally, ends up in shareholder bank accounts as well as on the Hill. Nevertheless, we don't have it to send. He knows that now. I mean, one of the things I covered in this article will be out in the American Conservative is kind of a rule of thumb that is used inside the Department of Defense to determine our readiness for war. Just when we just look exclusively at missiles, the standard family of missile systems like the S-6, standard missile 6, or we look at Tomahawks or anything else, we look at the magazine and we say in the magazine, that is in the cells, in the launchers, we would like to have at least 3 missiles for every cell in every launcher. That means each tube conceivably has 3 missiles waiting to be fired. And you may have 10 tubes or 12 tubes or 13 tubes or 5 tubes, whatever it is in the launcher system, whatever type of missile it is, doesn't matter. We want at least 3. Ideally, however, if you think there's a danger of being caught up in a high-end conventional war, you want 5 missiles for every cell in every launcher. We're not there. We just aren't there, which means we lose the missile war of attrition. And our manufacturing base is not punking out vast quantities of missiles and rockets and shells and other kinds of things. Just isn't. It's operating pretty much the way it always has. There has been an uptick, but that's modest to almost irrelevant compared with the situation in Russia. And remember that Russia's manufacturing base, it is operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, stockpiling as much as possible for the outside probability that we're dumb enough to go to war with Russia in Europe. Russia also has a neighbor next door called China, with the largest manufacturing base in the world. And that manufacturing base can operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for however long is required. I think that's being driven home to President Trump. I think he understands that now. So he says, wait a minute, we can't bully these people into submission. In other words, we can't tell them, we'll just bury you in missiles. Can't be done. This is not 1962, 63, Cuban Missile Crisis. We have so much more than you do. You have no choice but to back down and move out. That's not the case anymore. We don't have that advantage. So he wants to make a deal. Okay, what's the deal, Donald? The deal that Donald wants is, hey, come on down, celebrate. I got a ceasefire. We're on the road to peace. He gets in his plane, he flies home, celebrates. What's happened to the peace that he achieved in the Middle East? It's dead. Who are we kidding? It's a joke. The Israelis aren't going to stop fighting. They haven't even accomplished the goals they set for themselves. We're going to see more action there. So he's looking for the win. The Russians, on the other hand, are saying, look, we've got to get along, not just regionally, but globally. We need to come to some sort of new understanding, a new security architecture. Dan, they've been talking about this since December of 2021. We've just refused to listen. We've ignored it. We haven't even read their proposals, many of which were very, very good and would work to our advantage. But if it's not what we want, we don't care. We're not interested. And, you know, President Trump is not the sort of person that says, give me this material here. I'll read it tonight. We'll talk tomorrow afternoon at 3. We'll go over it in detail. And we'll decide what we think we can or cannot do. He doesn't do that. He doesn't read the material. He doesn't study it. And so you have to get in there and you have to sort of get his attention, which has recently happened, by the way, and tell him, look, these are the facts, boss. We don't have the 3 to 5 missiles per cell per launcher. We don't have that. So we can't go down this route. So stop promising these people. Stop threatening these people. It's a bad idea. That's a game that we're not positioned to win. Okay, that's good news. Thank goodness somebody got to him and pointed that out. But I don't see that that translates into a larger vision for something that where there's no support. And right now, there's no support in Washington for what some people call a grand bargain. You know, not unless the grand bargain involves total demilitarization of Russia, an apology from Putin to this man Zelensky, and an end to the war. And all that's nonsense. That's fantasy. That's sick. But that's where too many people inside the Beltway are located right now.
And you mentioned what has been talked about, and the grand bargain that Trump apparently would like to, which we gave voice to a second ago over the weekend, where he's like, we'll just stop it on the current lines and sure, we'll maybe give him some Donbass. Well, Sergey Lavrov, foreign minister, was asked, I think it was yesterday, what does the Russian side think about that kind of a grand bargain?
Стало звучать из Вашингтона, что надо немедленно остановиться, не надо ничего больше обсуждать, остановиться, а там пускай истории рассудят. Ну, понимаете, если просто остановиться, это означает забыть про первопричины этого конфликта, который американская администрация с приходом к власти Дональда Трампа четко понимала и озвучивала это понимание. Я имею в виду обеспечение внеблокового, нейтрального, безъядерного статуса Украины, что предполагает отказ от каких-либо попыток втягивать ее в НАТО, и я имею в виду прекращение фактического геноцида русского и русскоязычного населения.
So he literally repeated everything there they've been saying since April 2022, which is demilitarization, denazification, rights for the Russian speakers that will still live within Ukraine, no NATO, and the root causes. That's what they've added here in the last two or so years. So no change whatsoever with that. So if you have Trump's vision over here and you have Sergey Lavrov and the Russians off the screen, it's so far away here, what do you do in Budapest?
Well, we have President Trump, I think, instinctively gets it to some extent, but he doesn't really have all the facts because he hasn't studied it and he doesn't listen very well. But I think it should be obvious that a ceasefire does not equate to peace, you know, and that kind of ceasefire doesn't turn into or transform into what Lavrov is talking about, which is a just outcome. Justice has to be achieved. How do you achieve justice? You admit certain things. You have to say, look, this war is a failure. We are mightily responsible for it. We helped to remove this government back in 2014. We've used all the wrong methods to drive Russia crazy. We've effectively waged undeclared war against them using the Ukrainian people as a proxy. That needs to be said privately and said, look, this is over. We're going to stop. We're not going to send anything more to Ukraine. We're going to get out. And we Americans recognize that just as Washington has legitimate national security interests in Mexico and the Caribbean Basin, Moscow has legitimate national security interests in Ukraine. Very simple. You've got to recognize that. And so the key challenge for Trump is let's stop meddling in this place. Let's get out of it. We should be focused on restoring American economic productivity and prosperity. That's what it's about. That's what's important. President Trump is living in a world where he believes that military power is the decisive factor in all matters. Sometimes, but not most of the time, and certainly not on Russia's doorstep in Eastern Europe, where Russia, in Trump's words, holds all of the cards. But now, turning around and saying, you know, it's time to go home, Americans. It's time to get back to the United States. It's time to focus on the economy. It's time to focus on what our interests are. You know, we're hearing about rare earths now, and everyone is in a panic over that. We've known about the rare earth issue for a very long time. We've done nothing about it. We've never built a refinery. We've been happy to be dependent upon the Chinese or anybody else. That has to end. If you look at his approach to tariffs, he's recently announced, well, I'm going to lift these tariffs on things that we cannot produce ourselves. Oh, really? Well, that's a brilliant decision, Mr. President. I guess Mr. Navarro never bothered to do his homework and figure out that there are a lot of things out there we cannot produce. We can't grow. We can't mine. And so it probably makes sense that we don't want to tariff everybody that way. There's no coherent strategy that makes sense. We haven't even identified what our national strategic interests are. And the number one national strategic interest of the United States is not to go to war with Russia. That's number one. So first, let's make that abundantly clear, because we don't want a nuclear exchange with Russia ever. So that's number one. Nobody ever brings that up. Even President Trump, he's reluctant to say that. You know, from time to time, you heard President Biden say, and sometimes President Trump will make some noises and say, oh, nuclear, we can't have that. We don't want a nuclear exchange. Okay, fine. Let's go further and state the obvious. No war between the United States and Russia. That's number one. That should be written into stone as far as we're concerned for the foreseeable future. By the way, I would add China to that. But we've got a lot of stupid people in Washington that think that's just fine. We just need to split China and Russia. We can handle China. Okay, good luck. That's a great idea. It's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. But nevertheless, you got people saying those things. So that's number one. Now, once you decide you don't want a war, it's no longer a question of a ceasefire. It's a question of how do we come to an amicable solution? That means you draw new boundaries. So the president should say, This is the map. He puts a map down. Let President Putin put a map down. These are the new boundaries. Oh, by the way, Ukraine's neutral. End of discussion. No longer open for debate. We don't need Ukraine as an ally in NATO. We don't need half the people in NATO who are allies. Eisenhower accurately said, the more people we have inside NATO, the more nations we have inside, the more territory we have to defend. And in the 1950s, when we had enormous military power and certainly vastly more nuclear power than the Soviets, we couldn't defend it all. And he said, so we can't defend it. He wanted to neutralize most of Eastern Europe. Neutralizing a state is a good thing. It puts a nice cordon sanitaire between yourselves, your friends, your allies, and your potential opponent. It's a very simple thing. It's a very good thing. There's nothing bad about it.
Yep.
We need to get out of this whole collective security nonsense. We don't want a Finnish farmer who exchanges shots with the Russians over the border and then loses his farmhouse in a hail of artillery to suddenly bring the United States into war. This is back to the stupidity and insanity of the Tsar in 1914, who decided we have to help the 5 or 6 million Serbs who are Orthodox Christians like us against the Austrians, knowing full well when he did that, it would mean war with Germany instantly. And of course, he was being egged on by the French and the British. Oh, yeah, go ahead, jump in there. We'll be with you. What a catastrophe. It destroyed Russia. It will destroy us if we don't get out of this business once and for all. So this whole notion of collective security rooted in the 19th century, basically, it needs to be fundamentally modified or simply abandoned, because we are not going to live and should not live as a nation in a state of permanent hostility with anybody.
Yeah.
There's no need. Very well said. You know, someone today that we don't agree with may turn out to be a valuable ally tomorrow morning. And that's the way we should look at the international environment. We should talk about limited liability partners. We cooperate with the Russians today on this matter, but next week we may not be able to. That doesn't mean they're the enemy. That simply is, on this issue, we don't share the same interests. Then it's a question of determining, well, your interest there is more important than mine is, so I'm not going to get involved. It's very simple. We don't have any interest in Ukraine. We never did. Russia does. So acknowledge that interest and say, how can we help end this thing, preserve whatever we can of Ukraine in a way that makes sense, and that has to be neutrality, and then let's get on with it. But again, as I said at the outset, I don't think President Trump is a free agent.
Well, and there's other agents that would like to keep it that way and would like to keep Trump connected in there, and they're doing everything they can. I mentioned the Europeans at the beginning, more on them in a second, but let's also look at the other, I guess, kind of elephant in the room, and that is Ukraine, you just mentioned, and Volodymyr Zelensky is trying to keep those ties connected.
We are not losing this war, and Putin is not winning. And really, his army now in the weak position, I think so, because they really, from the beginning of this war, they could occupy 1% of our land, but they spend 1,300,000 people. And I think this is high price, yes, for such land. And I don't understand why the leader of the country, which is the biggest, which has the biggest territory in the world, they need some more kilometers. That's why I think that this war is not about the land and not about territories for him. It's about our sovereignty and about our independence.
Now, there we can quibble about what the Russians' interests are, but your point is very valid there. There are interests in Russia between those two, which are not mirrored on our side. And yet, that kind of comment that was on American television, of course, gets beamed right into the White House, and there's so many in the West, at least in the elite part of the West, that want to keep that bond connected. What can be done about that?
If Zelensky's mouth is moving, lies are being told. Nothing the man said was true. Not a word. just as Americans are demanding the Epstein file be released, they ought to demand the release of the Zelensky file, because we've got one. Unfortunately, our intelligence agents are apparently all in favor of continuing this perpetual war of hostility towards Russia. I don't see any evidence that Mr. Radcliffe is going to release the truth, but he ought to release the Zelensky file. And Zelensky is very comfortable in company with somebody like Epstein. This is a very, very corrupt, criminally corrupt state. The Ukrainian people are sick of it. They're tired. They're worn out. They don't want to live under him and in this state of perpetual uncertainty and fear. This is the ultimate Stalinist secret policeman who is jailing people in churches, jailing people that are opposed to his policies, and continues to force old men and boys in the uniform to be slaughtered at the front. The Russians have not sustained those losses. We know that. That's nonsense. 130,000 dead is a large number by any stretch of the imagination on the Russian side, but it pales before 1.7 to 1.8 million dead Ukrainian soldiers. And we don't even know what the tally of wounded is, but it's horrific because they can't provide the medical care. They can't evacuate people from the battlefield. It's all nonsense. We also know that Mr. Putin and his colleagues are absolutely disinterested under any and all circumstances in governing Western Ukraine. They don't want to govern those people. I mean, the standard joke in Moscow is, well, let the Poles come back in and take charge of Western Ukraine, which they controlled for hundreds of years. And the Poles came to grief over it. Ukrainians hated them with a passion. So they're... In other words, there's no solution to this that remotely resembles anything that Mr. Zelensky mentions. But he's got the support of the media. He's got the support of the financial interests, all the same people who want to go to war and destroy Iran and who are now beating the war drums for Venezuela and potentially Colombia. Who knows? It's outrageous, but that's where we are. The American people don't really get it because they're not being given the truth about anything. That's why I say, let's release the Zelensky file.
We're going to get to some of the truth here on that, but one other category and one other constituency to add to the list that you just mentioned about who wants it, that is the European elite. And that's going to be led by Keir Starmer, Merz, and this man here, Macron.
Regarding the meeting to take place between President Trump and President Putin, I believe it is a good thing that they can meet to discuss their bilateral agenda. Should they be discussing the fate of Ukraine, the Ukrainians should be sitting at the table. Should they be discussing European matters and the security of Europe, the Europeans should be at the table. That being said, we shall continue to support Ukraine, which is resisting in a very courageous way. They continue to fight and to produce, and on Friday, a meeting of the Coalition of the Willing will take place. Some will attend in London, others by a video link, and President Zelensky will be there. The only peace that can exist is a long-lasting peace that meets the requirements of international law and sets the condition of stability. There is no alternative, and the Europeans have always been clear in this respect.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that they're also clear on is just almost contradictory thing that I want to go to Budapest to be part of those peace negotiations. At the same time, I want to continue to help Ukraine with war material, and we want to just keep going down that path. I mean, those things are just contradictory, but yet how does that pass for elite thinking in the Western Europe?
Well, they're interested in disrupting whatever occurs in Budapest, assuming that that event actually occurs between President Trump and President Putin. What they don't want is the kind of discussion that you and I are having. They don't want an agreement for the reasons we've already outlined. I think Macron and Starmer and Merz are all giving good testimony in the court of history for why rebellions are necessary from time to time inside its societies. Europe has not had a true rebellion or series of rebellions for a very, very long time. But I think it's getting to the point now where the people of Great Britain, France, and Germany are going to have to come to terms with the reality that to survive as nation states, to emerge from the terrible tragedies and crises that they've been being dragged into by these globalists, the people that are governing them will have to be forcibly removed. Because the parliamentary systems, though in many ways are attractive because they're a little more flexible than what we have. In other words, you can still hold a vote of confidence and remove a prime minister and his government, and that's helpful. Although recent legislation in Britain apparently makes that tougher right now. But we are more presidential system, much like Macron's system at this point. Once the man is in there, unless you can convince both chambers to remove him through impeachment, you're stuck. And I think right now the people of Europe, particularly Great Britain, France, and Germany, are stuck. I don't see how they survive this and get out of the mess they're in unless they forcibly remove these people, because there is no interest in any of these countries in going to war with Germany, or excuse me, with Russia. And the notion that you're going to pour, what is it, hundreds of billions of euros into defense and magically snap your fingers and within 12 to 18 to 24 months produce a brand new military establishment that can defeat Russia is absurd. Makes no sense at all. And we all know there is no unity of command in NATO. We have sort of herded cats in various directions as the leaders of NATO, but NATO is not an authoritarian structure. And in order to be effective militarily, it must be authoritarian. You have to have absolute unity of command.
Now, what do you say to those folks who would be alarmed by that kind of talk? And they say, wait a minute, you're talking about authoritarian command and people rising up and overturning the legally elected governments in your country.
I'm talking about rebellion. That's written into our Constitution. This was the dispute that happened in 1860-61, where people said, we have a right to secede. It's written into the Constitution. I think every human population on the planet, regardless of where they live and what nation state they reside, has, I would argue, the God-given right to rebel when they see that their rights are being utterly ignored and their country is being dragged into the abyss and destroyed. That's my point. Now, as far as what I'm trying to say about NATO, when I talk about an authoritarian structure, I'm talking about the fact that militarily, these various nations, if they tried to pool their resources and go to war, couldn't do it because there's no unity of command. There's no agreement. You put anybody in command and every single nation in NATO, all 34 members now, they all have a vote. In other words, there's no one that can stand up and say, tomorrow we execute the following operation, everyone will comply. You know, we say English and French are the two languages of command. Well, you can throw French out. Nobody speaks French except the French. Nobody wants to speak French. So that leaves you with English. How deep does English go before you have true unity of command inside the NATO forces? That's why this discussion of the NATO force is a farce. There is none. This was something that we saw during World War II. We had enormous problems with unity of command with both the British and American and Canadian forces. There were different opinions, different attitudes. Each of these various army groups and air forces was maneuvered and moved and employed in different ways at different times because of national leadership. It was very, very difficult. That didn't exist on the Soviet side at all. There were Polish divisions inside the Soviet army, but there was no Polish army, if you understand my drift. In other words, there was absolute unity of command, and that produced a very different outcome on the battlefield against the Wehrmacht than anything we could produce. And we're not in a position to enforce or impose any of these things. So the whole notion of going to war with Russia is absurd. It makes no sense. I listened to Donald Tusk, the poll, telling everybody, well, NATO has so much more in terms of resources and money than Russia. There's no competition. Well, good luck with that. See if you can organize it unify it and employ it effectively. Yeah. No, you can't. That's the problem. Now, it was never a problem for NATO as long as NATO remained defensive. Because in a war in which you are defending your territory, everything changes. But we're not talking about defending Europe. We're talking about attacking Russia. That's offensive warfare. That's radically different. Putin doesn't want anything to do with that. And that's not because of weakness. It's not because the Russians can't fight. Look at how much trouble they're having with the Ukrainians. They're not having very much trouble except pushing the bodies into the mass graves that are emerging all over eastern Ukraine. Ukraine has become a graveyard. That's the tragedy in all of this. And Zelensky talks as though nothing like that has happened. He's lying. It has happened. He's destroyed that country. He's the criminal who has murdered millions of his own people in pursuit of a goal that was never attainable, the destruction of Russia. So this all has to end. I don't think President Trump, even if he understood it all, and I think he understands some of it, can end it, though. That's the problem, because he's got too many people that are insistent on keeping this going. And they are tied to the same globalists in the United States and Europe that we've been talking about. The globalists have an agenda. No borders, destroy national identity, unify everybody, erase their national language, national identity, national culture, live in the great amorphous mass of globalized world. That's failed. No one in Europe wants that. The EU is a failure because the EU that began as an economic structure became a governing structure and has tried to shove supranational law and behavior down everybody's throats. Nobody wants it. People want to live as they see fit. They want to live with other people like themselves that share their culture, their language, their way of life. We've treated that as though that's the enemy. And that is one of the key driving forces behind the war against Russia. Because Russia has said, no thanks, we're not interested in that. The Hungarians have said, no thanks. The Czechs have said, no thanks now, and so have the Slovaks. I think the Serbs are saying the same thing. That's why they're being castigated every day for not doing enough to align with EU norms. Well, that's like saying, jump into the grave with the rest of us and all die here in Europe. That's absurd, but that's where we are. And I think, again, President Trump, he's not a globalist, but he's in the grip of globalists, and he's being pushed in directions that he probably would otherwise not go.
Okay.
I don't see something really dramatic coming out of Budapest.
So, yeah, and I certainly hope that's the case, but I want to go down further that path right there you meant about where maybe President Trump's being pushed in some directions. And I also simultaneously want to look at what you said about rebellions, because that's going to scare a lot of people when they talk about rebellion, because they may not like this policy or that, but it terrifies them to think about a rebellion because of where it could lead. But part of the pressure that is on to cause that, I think, is that when people think that they voted for one thing and then they're not getting it. And I want to look at that even within the administration on this whole Maduro thing in Venezuela. So we've had there was an article out here where Marco Rubio has been privately leading Trump's pressure campaign against Venezuela. And if that wasn't strong enough, then we had Lindsey Graham yesterday use the strongest language to date to say what he's going to claim in this clip here is what the American people want. Now, as we listen to this, I'm in my ear already hearing echoes of what you said earlier in here, that America's number one priority is not to have war with Russia, but it's not to have a war with anybody we don't need to. And yet,
Venezuela is a narco-terrorism state run by Maduro, who's had associations with Iran. He steals from his own people. It is a staging area to bring drugs into this country. And when you voted for Donald Trump, here's what you voted for. Mr. President, there's a speedboat headed to America full of drugs. What should we do? Blow it up. But we're going to the next step. We're just not going to blow up the boat. We're going after the people who load the boat in the country that provides safe haven to the narco terrorists who run the drug cartels. Bernie's going to talk to you about Colombia, but I want to let people know the Trump doctrine is pretty Simple. If you're a friend, you'll have no better friend than America. If you're an enemy to America, will be your worst nightmare. So Donald Trump is going to take Maduro down, and everybody's talked about how bad Maduro is. He's going down.
Is that what Americans voted for, though, that we want a Trump mandate to take out a regime change in Venezuela? What do you make of that?
No, that's complete and utter nonsense. In fact, if anything, people like I did and many others went into the voting booth. We voted for the man because he promised to end all these wars, get out of all these wars. If you go back to the run-up to Wilson's re-election, the banner that flew everywhere with Woodrow Wilson for Woodrow Wilson's re-election was, he kept us out of war. Yeah.
How'd that turn out?
And remember FDR, I will not send American boys to die on foreign soil. And everybody said, okay, we're for that. Remember LBJ in the run-up to Vietnam? He said, I will not send American boys to die in Vietnam to do the job that Vietnam's boys ought to do.
He said it just like that, too. He did.
Yeah. It was wonderful, wasn't it? It's all crap. Yeah. Now, this man has completely left the planet. I don't think the people of South Carolina are remotely interested in a war with Venezuela. If you want to stop the drugs, you stop them when they enter your territorial waters or they try to cross your borders. If you want the drug problem to go away, then you crack down inside the United States. You enforce federal law. We watched this massive demonstration of No King's Business, and I'm beginning to be told by people in the intelligence business that the same people that funded Antifa and the George Floyd business are now funding the No King's nonsense. What they don't understand is that this is about enforcing federal law inside the United States. That's what we need to do. We need to enforce federal law. We need to enforce state law. We have not been enforcing our laws. If you don't enforce your laws, one of two things has to happen. You go out of business. Your society collapses. Your nation dissipates, disintegrates. Or you change the laws. Now, I don't think Americans voted for open borders, but they got them. And nothing has really been done to the people that did that to us. The decision to open our borders and admit millions of people about whom we knew nothing and didn't need in this country at all for any reason has never been challenged. No one has ever stood up and said, well, who are the culprits? Who are the people that did this to us? I mean, President Trump talks about the Venezuelan gang members that are here in the United States. He's 100% right. And I agree 100% with the actions taken thus far by the FBI and ICE and other agencies in the Department of Homeland Security and Justice to deal with them harshly. I'm 100% for that. But that's very different from declaring war on a foreign country whose role in all of this, frankly, in Venezuela is minuscule. I mean, anyone will tell you that. Colombia, yes. Ecuador, yes. And there's some others.
But China, India are even bigger than.
Yeah, but I mean, China, are you going to solve the problem by bombing China or bombing India?
Exactly. Exactly the point.
And these nations, when you talk about India and China, there are over 1 billion people in these countries. Does everyone really think that the Indian government and the Chinese government are cultivating and encouraging lawlessness? No, they're not. But you're dealing with nations that are very, very large and difficult to control. You know, I would prefer they did the policing, and I would encourage them to police to the best of their ability. I don't want to police those places. I don't want to govern those places. If you go into Venezuela, you're going to have to police the place. You know, it's like I think it was the Minister of Defense from Italy who told the Supreme Commander of Allied Powers Europe back in 1998, you know, if we go into Kosovo, we will replace the Serbs. We don't want to replace the Serbs. We have enough Albanians as it is. We don't want to govern Albanians. We don't want to administer them. Well, the same thing holds true on a much larger and more dangerous scale in a place like Venezuela. And the other thing is that all these surrounding countries in Latin America, they've already been primed through various kinds of information, education, socialization to say, here we go again. The evil Yankees are back, doing more dangerous things to us. I mean, it's sort of like sending the British Army to the Republic of Ireland. What a dumb idea that would be. Every Irishman would come, would rise up in rebellion, and with good reason. We're inviting stupidity and disaster.
So Doug, let me ask you, you're right, because I looked just earlier this past week. When you rank countries of origin where drugs are entering illegally into the United States, Venezuela is number 20. So if it's that low down on the list, why are we putting so much effort in? Why is Lindsey Graham just pounding the desk talking about, let's go take him out? Why would we do something like that on someone who's that small? Is it as simple as there's oil in Venezuela?
Well, a lot of it has to do with natural resources. There's no question about it. But I think you also have a flight of fantasy on the strategic level in Washington. Just as we used to listen to people all the time say, well, we have to split Russia and China. If we can split them, then we can bring in Russia on our side against China. This is, you know, what do you think this is, 1870, 1900? It's not. It's ridiculous. It's silly nonsense. Today, economic power is far more important than military power. And what we've forgotten is that as your economic strength and productivity declines, your military power falls behind.
Right with it, yeah.
But we're not thinking in those terms. And so, you know, this is almost gunboat diplomacy in the style of Teddy Roosevelt. Well, we'll send a few gunboats and we'll send a battalion of Marines and we'll beat these people into submission. This is not going to work. It's a prescription for failure. But we have people strategically convincing themselves, well, we're flipping the board on Russia and China. They thought they were going to get into Venezuela. Well, they won't get there because we'll be there. You know, I remember Nicaragua. Nobody today remembers much about Nicaragua. Back in the 80s under Reagan, there were all sorts of people, sadly, that I knew in the United States Army. Oh, this is great. Let's go into Nicaragua. And they thought, well, this is the dream of the light infantry community. We'll send in the light divisions. That's what they're there for. And a friend of mine who will remain nameless, but who is familiar with the region and thought strategically, he said, well, if I were the Soviets, I'd send a brigade of Soviet military police to direct U.S. traffic into Nicaragua. What a catastrophe that will be. You know, we'll go there. We'll spend huge quantities of money. A lot of people will get killed. Absolutely nothing will be achieved. We've got to get back to something that we never hear anymore, which used to be popular in the medical community. It was first, do no harm. Don't perform surgery unless it's absolutely necessary. Any surgery is by nature intrusive. As soon as it's intrusive, you risk all sorts of problems, infection, more disease, accidents. So surgery is your last option. We've made surgery on the international level our first option. And going into Venezuela is not going to fundamentally change anything strategically in our favor. Now, the people that think they're going to get control of all the oil and natural gas, and maybe they're going to march inland and get those gold mines and emerald mines, I don't know. But if you try to do that, how long is it before suddenly some of these oil derricks begin to blow up? How long before your soldiers that are policing the area in some of the areas of Caracas start dying? In other words, you're inviting disaster. This just doesn't make any sense. And how many times have we told, oh, this will be a cakewalk? You know, that's one of the reasons I talked about the generals. Beware of these generals. If you're president of the United States, beware of the general who walks in and says, come on, boss, we can do it. We've got it. We'll get the job done. Give us the mission. I mean, okay, who are these people? Well, I mentioned a couple. One was a general division commander in 1950 in Korea, and he predicted that once his troops landed in Korea, that the North Koreans would be so shocked and afraid they'd run away. Okay. Max Hastings, the historian that's written so many books on these things, said that the rout of the 24th Infantry Division in 1950 in Korea was so complete, it resembled the disintegration of the French in 1940, and the British in Singapore. So much for that. Then you had this man, Paul Harkins. He was Patton's G3 towards the end of the Second World War. He was a 4-star, and he was the first commander of this military assistance command, Vietnam. And he said, well, we can win this war by Christmas of 1963. The South Vietnamese troops are great. They're doing a brilliant job and so forth. Well, they had some battles with the VC and they lost. So he reported those as victories because that was the message his bosses in Washington wanted to hear. So I said, this really wasn't a defeat, a minor setback, but in truth, it was a victory. Have you heard that kind of logic before? You know, we left triumphant from Afghanistan. We were victorious, right? And then we have this General Donahue, who was one of the architects of the triumphal retreat from Afghanistan, who says, well, we can overrun and take Kaliningrad in what, 2 days, 24, 48 hours? I know we can do this.
It'd be easy, I think is how he put it.
Really? You know, what planet are these people on? And if you're president of the United States and you have people like that with 3 and 4 stars on their shoulders saying stupid remarks like that, you should be very afraid. Because that doesn't pass the common sense test. I think we're hearing the same crap about Venezuela. And then if you stand up and you point to the obvious, these are the reasons why you don't want to go in there and you don't want to stay. I mean, for instance, in Iraq, one of the things I've got to give people credit for in 2002, when I talked to them down in Central Command, is that the leadership in the Army, at least at the top of Central Command, understood you don't want to stay in Iraq. If you go in there, you go in, you execute the mission, put another bunch of generals in charge, and you get out. You don't stay. Now, we all know what actually happened. But people say, well, why wasn't there a plan to occupy Iraq? Because we didn't have a spare million men to send to do it. And we didn't want to do it. And we knew it was a disastrous idea. We did it. It was a disaster. My point is, President Trump needs to sit quietly in a room and think about all of this and then ask, what kinds of people am I dealing with? The people that tell me, oh, this is easy. This is a cakewalk. We can bully these people to our heart's content. And ask, is that really true? Is that really in our interest? Is that really what we need to do? I mean, you saw him in the Oval Office where he was asked point blank. We understand that President Maduro made an offer to you about a stake in the oil and gas industries in Venezuela. Was that not true? Oh, yes. Yes, he did. He offered everything. Well, why isn't that enough?
Yeah.
Well, that's not enough. What isn't enough? What do you want? You know, we're in a very dangerous position right now. I don't know where we'll be in 6 months or 12 months, but if we end up where I think we're going, he's in a lot of trouble. And he's only been president for less than a year.
That's the big issue there. It's because, like you said at the start of this, you have the piece that he's already taken full credit for that it hasn't even been had phase two negotiated yet. Certain it's far from certain that's even going to stay stable. You obviously have the situation of Ukraine, which you could definitely go all the way against Ukraine. Probably will, given enough time. And then now this one down here. If we get into there, if all of these go bad on his watch, it's going to be pretty tough to get anything done, to even make it through 4 years and not be removed from office one way or the other. It's that serious, I think.
And we have not talked at all about the supposedly irrelevant national sovereign debt. I mean, somebody pointed out to me the other day, don't you understand that private debt is even worse than public debt? Sure. But the public debt is important because when it collapses, when it crashes, you have no government. There is no administration. Everything stops. Who's paying the police? Who pays the bureaucrats to do their jobs? In other words, the potential for apocalyptic change as a result of financial collapse is real. Nassim Taleb, who's talked about this in great detail, and many, many others, have warned this sort of thing. We need some rationality in Washington. We need to understand that the problems that we confront at home are far more serious and existential than anything happening overseas. And going somewhere else to fight another war is not a solution. You know, you would think after the No Kings demonstrations, even though I find the funding of all of this reprehensible, and we've begun to figure out who's behind it. Nevertheless, look at that and understand the potential for unrest inside the United States. why do you want to court this sort of thing with action overseas in other people's countries?
Right. And by the way, I want to be very clear, make sure nobody misunderstands what I was saying. I'm not saying that President Trump is worried, he needs to worry about somebody else coming in and taking from power. I'm actually talking about his own supporters, and I'm talking about by existing legislative means. There are ways to get that done. That if he loses the support of his own side, and he can, if they finally start paying enough of a price, and especially if you overlay on the economic issue that causes problems inside, there's going to be some real trouble. So I think that the wise thing to do is to recognize these things, just like you suggested. I'm a strong advocate of that. And let's change some policies while we still have a time to navigate this to avoid some of the worst outcomes.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And in this connection, I would let the Europeans stew in their own juices. And eventually the European peoples will take care of the problem. We don't need to do it.
Yeah, and but it turns out that Gary's always on top of it like he is. And you mentioned that soundbite from President Trump in the Oval Office the other day. Gary found it.
Maduro offered everything in his country, all the natural resources. He even recorded a message to you in English recently offering mediation. What could we do to stop that?
He has offered everything. He's offered everything. You're right. You know why? Because he doesn't want to fuck around with the United States.
Pretty harsh language there. But the bigger question remains, if that be true and you recognize it, then we don't need to be going down Lindsey Graham's route. That's not necessary. So we'll have to wait and see how that's going to play out.
Yeah. Well, remember, the Serbs met 90% of the conditions outlined for them by the Austrians in Vienna in 1914. It wasn't good enough. It was absolutely enough, but they rejected it, and we know the rest is history. You've got to be very careful about these kinds of things.
Indeed.
Now is to be incautious.
Yeah, and wise. Take the win, bottom line. Take the win when you've got it. Exactly. Well, listen, we really appreciate you coming on today, as always, Doug. Very illuminating and interesting conversation today. Super appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. I appreciate it very much.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't done that. But also bear in mind that we are on podcast. And I know a lot of your friends prefer to get their information on podcasts. Let them know Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and they'll find us there. Let them know about that stuff. DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com for your friends who actually like the written word. Hey, folks, we are unintimidated and uncompromised, as you see in this episode here, really on graphic display. Make sure you don't keep this stuff to yourself. Share this with your friends in whatever form they like it the most, so they, too, can get access to the same information. We really appreciate you, and we'll see you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.